This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. The Reverend William Barber, president of the North Carolina NAACP, architect of the Moral Monday protest movement and repairers of the breach. His most recent books include Forward Together, A Moral Message for the Nation, and The Third Reconstruction, Moral Mondays, Fusion Politics, and the Rise of a New Justice Movement.
William Barber, one of the nation's leading theologians, advocates tirelessly for the rights of the poor, the imprisoned, the disenfranchised, and the working class, obliterating the social, cultural, religious, and political barriers in society.
Barber's work is about building a progressive agenda rooted in a moral framework to counter the ultra-conservative constructs that try to dominate the public square. He brings together people from different faith traditions with people without a spiritual practice, but who share the moral principles at the heart to repair the breaches caused by centuries-old systems of racial and gender inequality. Be prepared to be truly inspired.
Pentecost is central to our understanding and offers us a new way forward in every moment of crisis. Moral revolution, if you will, a revival. Pentecost is about a new thing. It's not simply the next chapter in an ever-evolving story, but a radical new thing, an interruption of the way things are that brings about transformation for everyone, even Herod and Caesar. Thomas Kuhn called it a paradigm shift. The founders of this nation talked about it in terms of revolution. Dr. King referred to it as the Zeitgeist. But whatever you call it, there are times when a deep moral crisis demands that the way we have framed things up until now are insufficient. It is manifestly clear, I believe, that we are living in such a time. And this text from Acts helps us to see how in this moment we need this political Pentecost. We need a new fire and we need a new wind. If we get our language right, we can start to see some new things and we can start to feel a new wind blowing across this land. Something is happening out there. Moral values and a moral framework has been the backbone of every great progressive movement. I've gone back and started reading some of the debates, like for Social Security and debates around civil rights. I can't find where they talked in left and right language. Lyndon Baines Johnson, he didn't talk about the war of poverty in terms of left and right. He talked about the moral issues, civil rights as a moral issue. Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, listen, any company that will not pay its workers 25 cents an hour does not even deserve to be in America. He never talked about this as a left position or right position. He would not allow himself to be boxed in like that. Abraham Lincoln didn't talk about it, the union as a left issue or right issue. Almost all of the great progressive things that we've seen, this language shift happened. The social gospel, when they looked at children dying because of the lack of child labor and people dying without labor rights and people in slums and poverty and not having a minimum wage, they didn't say, what's the left position? They asked another question, what would Jesus do? There would have been no labor movement without this kind of framing and underpinning. There would have been no abolition movement without William Lloyd Garrison. And when he was asked, why was he in jail? He said, I've been put in jail by a respectable mob for preaching the damnable gospel that all men are created equal. I am not in here because I'm a lefty or a righty. Go back sometime and read Dr. King, that first sermon, when Rosa Parks had sat down, her and the women had been playing. They were like Shiprah and Puah. They had been playing all the while to take on Pharaoh. And Dr. King has to preach this sermon within 15 minutes at the first mass meeting. There's not a word in there about left and right. He said, if we're wrong, God is wrong. If we're wrong, the Constitution is wrong. Different way of framing issues. There would never have been a critique on poverty and unchecked capitalism and labor rights and health care and criminal justice reform and climate change and raising the minimum wage without a moral premise underneath it. And my God, we must reclaim that language today. If I were to say anything to any seminary, make sure your students come out of here knowing how to speak in tongues. In the tongues of justice. The tongues of love, and make sure they know how to speak in the public square, not just in the comfortness of the upper rooms or the upper areas of their sanctuary. One writer said, Trump ran his campaign sensing the feeling of dispossession and anxiety among millions of voters, white voters in the main, and many other voters, not all, but many followed Trump because he was willing to trumpet their fury and affirm their sense of deeply rooted in this nation's history of race and class, that the new world had conspired against their interests. Now Trump, this writer says, offered no answers. He merely said, you're right to be afraid and very afraid. Obama is the boogeyman of a coming diversity that will undo the world you grew up knowing. And I alone can save you. And we need to step back a minute and understand what we're really dealing with here. Neil went on to say, we do face a dire situation, but it's not new. Trumpism is as American as apple pie. There could be no Donald Trump without America's first black president. We're experiencing a white lash. Every stride toward freedom in U.S. history has been met with the same backlash. We have to understand this moment. We faced it during the Reconstruction. In the shadow of the slavery and amid the wreckage of the Civil War, African Americans joined hands with whites in the North and South who were willing to see one another as allies. Within 4 years after the end of the Civil War, white and black alliances controlled every state house in the South. They were shaping the nation. Together they elected new leaders. Almost all of the Southern legislatures were controlled by either a predominantly black alliance or a strong interracial fusion coalition. They hammered out new constitutions from a deeply moral perspective. If you know this history, then you can begin to understand why at the very time, if you register 30% of the unregistered voters in America, in the South, and they connect with whites and Latinos, you have a new South and a new nation. If you know this history, you understand why are we seeing some of the things we're seeing. Fusion coalitions 150 years ago, they built the first public schools rooted in moral language. In fact, where I come from, the Constitution of 1868 in North Carolina has a clause, Article 11, Section 4, beneficent provision for the poor, the children, and the unfortunate, and the orphan is the first duty of a Christian civilization. Can you imagine that being the new Constitution coming out of slavery? They were talking about labor rights in 1870s, 1880s. They expanded the ballot. And post-slavery, black and whites working together opened up the ballot. They said it's immoral. They shifted the criminal justice system. But within 4 years, First Reconstruction faced powerful opposition. Many former Confederates saw black citizenship and interracial alliances as sin. They organized the Ku Klux Klan to terrorize white people first, whom they saw as traitors to the way of righteousness. Then they attacked leaders, then the deconstructionists. They began to wail against taxes because they believed it was a sin to raise taxes in order to lift up the very people that you had disenfranchised before. They wanted states' rights. They wanted their own enclaves of their of righteousness according to their mindset. They did not want to see all of this coming together. They despised public education because they didn't believe some children were legitimate and should be trained. They stood against labor rights because they still held on to the perspective that some human beings were not as worthy as others. And then in 1877, you have an election that was a selection. A man gets elected. Well, he gets selected. He loses the popular vote. He wins the Electoral College, but he has to cut a deal. The deal is, I'll cut taxes. I'll pull the law enforcement protection out of the South, and I'll give you back the Supreme Court. And the mantra of that era, in essence, was, we've got to take America back and make it great again. Second Reconstruction, the Civil Rights Movement. Civil rights, labor, immigrants, women, poor folk came together began to shift. The Civil Rights Act, voting rights, Fair Housing Act, war on poverty, all had deep moral underpinnings. But then there was a backlash. Then Kevin Phillips said, we can win this thing, Mr. Richard Nixon. We got to come up with a strategy to take America back and make it great again. We got to use all kind of code words to get poor whites to vote against their own self-interest. And then we have to find a way to limit the moral discussion to prayer in the school, anti-gay, anti-abortion, pro-tax cut, pro-gun conversation. We've glossed over this history. And a political Pentecost requires that we be illumined again to see it. So many people are so shocked by Donald Trump, we can't make sense of what's happening in front of us because somehow we fail to see that it's been happening all the while. The challenge to America moving forward began early. This is not some me trying to suggest that everything was perfect under Obama, far from that. But some people disagree with Obama on policy, like me and some of you. But some people disagreed with his very personhood. And everything they did was rooted in that. Like when they say, you lie. Not you are a liar. You lie. You lie. You, your existence. So Neil Painter then comes back and says, without Barack Obama, there's no Donald Trump. Trump is obviously unsuited for the job of president, but he was the nominee most suited to answer the call and response that is so characteristic of America. And to those that say, well, I'm not sure if race had any impact. You know, there are a lot of progressives now trying to find the economic silver bullet because we never want to deal with the race-class analysis together. Now, the evidence from the 2016 election is clear that the attitudes about blacks, immigrants, and Muslims were the key component of Trump's appeal. If we're going to overcome it, if we're going to be a movement in the midst of it, you have to know how we got in this place. And we need some moral fire to help us see clearly how this history shapes our present reality. Because I've heard too many people say over the past several months two things that irk me. One is we've never seen anything like this before. And I want to say, what? Donald Trump is not the first candidate to play on our worst fears and use divide and conquer tactics. 100 years ago, Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat, brought Birth of a Nation in the White House 100 years before Bannon was ever in the White House. Package may be different. Content is the same. And then the other thing, they say, oh God, it's the worst thing we've ever seen. Have you seen slavery, Holocaust, Jim Crow, lynching, denial of women's suffrage? Come on. The moral fire of a political Pentecost opens up our minds. But the fire of Pentecost will tell you, not only have we seen it before, we know how to beat it. Age after age after age, people have had to face it. And how did they face it? They came together. They built moral fusion coalition. They found common grounds. They linked arms together. They refused to be silent, and they refused to be divided. That's how it was beaten then. That's how it's going to be beaten now. If they had to turn back the playbook on the 1960s and pick up the white Southern strategy to win, if they had to lie and make up stories about widespread voter fraud and win, if they had to gerrymander voting district and fight tooth and nail in the courts to win, if they had to go all the way across the ocean and get a foreign government to help hack the emails to win, that must mean you're strong, because the blessing of an enemy sometimes is the enemy points out your strength, because the enemy wouldn't cheat you if the enemy could beat you on level ground. I'm telling you, the fire. But stop trying to find one thing that went wrong. We need an MRI, and that MRI that will help us understand and know where to do the surgery is M, morality and values, R, racial justice and diversity, I, income and economic injustice. And if we do the MRI with the illumination of Pentecost, then we'll see what's really going on, and what we really have to stand against is not just Trump, but we have to fight racism and poverty and the war economy. And those three things still make up that unholy Trinity that impacts so much of who we are. Yeah. Trump didn't win in November simply by appealing to the white working class. I'm not saying that the economic pain of white folks isn't real. I'm just saying they're not alone. Poor white people are hurting, just like poor black people and poor brown people. And the wealthiest cabinet in this nation's history is taking power because we can't let the dividers get away with pitting poor white people against poor people of color. If we're going to deal in this moment and we're going to organize in this moment, we have to stay together in our critique. Race and class and the war economy has to be the triad way in which we engage in our critique. And we have to be real careful to understand that the folks that have created this mess are not stupid. Because you got to ask a serious question. We have 8 million more poor white people in America than poor black people. And yet many of them have been persuaded to elect candidates who promise to end health care, defund public education, deny living wages, despite the fact that 64 million families live on less than a living wage, while 400 families make $97,000 an hour. There are 104 million people living below twice the poverty line. The richest 400 families in America own more than the bottom 50%. 1% own 42% of all the wealth. 57% of all African Americans make less than a living wage. That's a race issue and a class issue, all bound up together. And what are these folk using that they can bamboozle people? When 22 states in 2010 passed voter suppression laws and draw race-driven unconstitutional apartheid-like congressional and state legislative districts in states that represent the highest growth in black and brown voters, states that have 50% of black voters, 234 electoral votes, and 44 senators, while at the same time we have less voting rights protection than we had August 6, 1965. We have more than a class problem at work. We don't fix this by just finding the economic argument. Not Trump. Long before Trump, Ryan and McConnell and Boehner obstructed reinstituting the Voting Rights Act for over 3.5 years. And in the 2016 election, we had 868 less voting places in minority African American and poor communities. And not one serious question or one serious hour out of 26 presidential debates, Democrat and Republican, about the Voting Rights Act. Not one debate on living wages, Democrat or Republican. Something else is going on here. Where we went, organized, you see the South, you see the Rust Belt, something's going on out there. Every place, hundreds of clergy now trained, thousands of people coming out in churches that you wouldn't expect. In Birmingham, we did the training in a Jewish synagogue, had Baptists, Methodists, Charismatics, Pentecostals, Sikhs, Unitarians, Jewish brothers and sisters, Muslim, Fight for 15, Black Lives Matter, healthcare advocates, policy people, all in the same room. Then that night we were in a Baptist church in the Black Hood that was as diverse as everything you've ever seen. Every one of those places at 11 o'clock simultaneously, hundreds of people walked into governor's offices to serve notice that we are now calling for a higher ground moral declaration. And more than 10,000 clergy and activists sound for it. People say we can't be unified. That happened last year on September the 12th. All at the same time, walked in and sat down. Didn't get arrested that time. This is right. There are people all over this area that want to hear not a Democratic argument, not a Republican argument, but a new moral argument. And through the fire of Pentecost, we can see that there's possibility in Judea. There's possibility in the othermost parts of the world. There's possibility in Samaria. We need a fresh wind. Language and vision or illumination and fire are important. But the text says the first thing that happened was the wind. We need a new moral fusion movement blowing in every community across this land. Same folk who are attacking public schools, attack health care, the same ones do that, attack the LGBT community, the same ones that do that, attack labor, attack Muslims, attack the immigrants, attack voting rights, attack living wages. And if they're cynical enough to blow a foul wind, then we have to be courageous and yielded enough to be a part of a fresh win. Because America needs more than a strategy to win back some seats for Democrats in 2018. We need a new moral Pentecostal wind that begins to blow against racism and poverty and the war economy. We need a wind that will blow us right out of this chapel, right down south, right in the Rust Belt, right in the Wheat Belt, and even in the places of New York that some people feel are off limits. We need the kind of wind that blew them out of that upper room, and they were no longer afraid of that Caesar who loved to build towers. They were no longer afraid of that Herod who built and put his money on the faces of the corn. And I'm convinced that some of what we're seeing is the last gasp of an order that is passing away. Pentecost in Acts tells us that 2,000 years ago, people were impressed by folks speaking in other tongues that weren't their own. Tongues got the ears' attention. The fire caught the eyes' attention. But the real miracle of that day was the wind blew people together that otherwise would be torn apart. One writer says to us in this moment, he says, the combination of economic anxiety, the insatiable greed of the Koch brothers and their ilk, and a barely subliminal racism against a black man serving in our country as president set the stage for what we see now. And then Donald Trump appropriated much of Sanders' rhetoric about Wall Street, bankers, billionaires, and the globalized economy. He added his own Trumpian vitriol against immigrants, African Americans, Muslims, gangs, drug dealers, and women. And to many people, they bought the con. But history shows that just getting rid of Trump will not fix everything that has gone wrong. Focusing on his obvious personality disorders may be entertaining, but it's not a winning strategy. This is a historical moment of realignments and transformations here and around the world. There's a fire wind, and Donald Trump is merely a symptom. And so we need a fresh wind. One of the first ways we be a part of a fresh wind is when a few weeks ago we announced the Souls of Poor Folk, auditing America since the Poor People's Campaign's challenge on racism, poverty, war, and national morality. You don't pass the 50th anniversary of a prophet's death without evaluating what the prophet stood for, where you are and where you aren't. And once you figure out where you aren't, the only way you can honor the prophet is to pick up from there and move forward. We are praying that this audit will begin to blow a fresh wind. We've got economists and poor people and historians and preachers and clergy sitting on this panel doing seriously, where are we? What? Not in the last 4 years, but in the last 50 years. Not Democrat or Republican, but let's examine the very foundations and the factors that have impacted America on what should be our deepest moral concerns: economic sustainability and poverty, healthcare, education, environmental justice, women's rights, criminal justice reform, the proliferation of guns, voting rights, immigrant justice, not just immigrant rights, immigrant justice. Where are we? And then, because we can't just have a piece of an audit, we've got to have a movement. And so we believe in this moment, we've got to not just keep the focus on Trump, but we've got to focus on how do we challenge these systems that create these symptoms. And so we must have a revival, a reimagination, an implementation of the Poor People's Campaign. We can no longer just go and have memorials and commemoration services. That's not how you honor prophets and prophetic movements. We must resurrect and embrace the vision. And we need a new Poor People's Campaign made up of clergy and poor people and artists and academics and people of every race and every gender to come together. And we need a season of resistance, not intermittent marches, but a season of resistance. What would happen if we had 40 days let's just say in 2018, what about starting on Mother's Day, 40 days? And what if we had clergy, Jewish and Muslim and imams and poor people leading groups of 25 or 50 into state capitals, and then groups of 100 going straight into the Capitol, not only outside in Washington, D.C., but right over to Ryan's office and right over to McConnell's office? And if we had an agenda out of this audit, and what if we began to sit down and every day they had to arrest us for 40 days? And what if we took a part of the poor people's campaigns, but where they went to D.C. and set up camp, what if we set up camp in 25 states and camp in the District of Columbia? And what if Union had three of those days where the president and students and others would lead something into the Capitol in Ryan? What if every seminary across the country holding hand with poor people and people without health care and immigrants? I mean, what if? Yeah, Dr. King had us on the way. Had us in the way, the system killed him on the way, and now it's time for us to find a way. We need to find a way to finish. Somebody said, well, what difference will it do? Well, I know one thing, if that many people get arrested for that many days, it's going to at least change the narrative. First, you have to have moral imagination, prophetic imagination, and then you get prophetic implementation, and so we need it, and so we are committed, and I hope you will join us. You can go to breachrepairers.org and begin to sign up, but we've got to build a movement that has some wind, that has some ruach, that began to shake the foundations of this nation. That's bigger than one president, but it's about principle. It's about changing the trajectory of the nation. It's not just a Democratic wind or a Republican wind or independent wind, but a moral wind. And I believe it's time. Right now, to 2018, if we do it right, we'll birth a movement that'll last another 15 or 20 years. We have to do it. We've got to have this new tongue and new fire, and we've got to have a movement that puts a new wind beneath the knee. What if for just 40 days, everybody could stay in their silos? You know, Black Lives Matter could do their thing, women could do their thing, environmentalists could do their thing for the other 325 days. But for 40 days, we decide to walk together, children, and decide to not be weary. You know, I think we can do it. Not because I just am, you know, an optimist. I am hopeful. I don't have to walk by faith altogether on this. I can walk by sight. Every major social movement in this nation has ever been won is because somebody came together and created a new wind. I feel a wind blowing. It's going to blow down south. It's going to blow all over America. We are not going to let the prophet's dream die. It's time. There's a new wind blowing.
Reverend William Barber with the Moral Mondays Movement, Repairers of the Breach, President of the North Carolina NAACP. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.